Want to welcome you to our week-long program in mindfulness and psychotherapy. And I think in light of the state of the world at the moment, we're going to have an emphasis on how to use these practices, certainly tailoring them to the needs of different people, but using them to work with uncertainty, using them to work with anxiety, depression, but particularly when those things arise in the context of not knowing what's going to happen next in our lives, because we're certainly at a period of time where many, many people don't know what's going to happen next in their life. Oh, thank you everybody for turning on your video. I know it's hard. It's also gonna make it hard to text or email or that kind of thing. It's somewhat deliberate. Where this is a course in mindfulness. Now, one of the ways that mindfulness can be understood is that mindfulness is learning how to single task. It's learning how to actually do one thing at a time wholeheartedly and pay attention to it. Because as it turns out, when we multitask, we defend. When we multitask, we block out feelings, thoughts that are unwanted. But when we single task, they tend to come into awareness. So I'm also going to ask you, you know, unless it's emergent, to single task here the same way we would if we were in a room together, as this course was originally scheduled. So I'll tell you a few words about me. So I'm Ron Siegel. I'm a clinical psychologist by training and an assistant professor part-time here at Harvard Medical School. And I've been spending the last quite a few years involved in investigating how mindfulness practices might inform psychotherapy, how compassion practices might inform psychotherapy, and the reverse, how what we know from neuroscience, how what we know from clinical practice, how what we know from psychological research can inform the wisdom traditions from which we derive mindfulness practices. Now, I started doing these practices quite a long time ago. If the video is any good, I started doing them when I was about 17. And if your video is clear, you can see that was really quite some time ago. And I've been doing them ever since. And, you know, the interesting thing is that for many years, I was involved in personally trying to make sense of psychotherapy in conjunction with mindfulness practices, because I started doing mindfulness practices long before I started doing psychotherapy. For the last, nearly 40 years, I've had the privilege to be part of a group here at Harvard Medical School of clinicians and researchers who have been looking at how these two things can inform one another. And I'll tell you, some 40 years ago when we started, we stayed pretty much under the radar. The Boston area was very heavily psychoanalytic. And frankly, none of us wanted to be accused of having unresolved infantile longings to return to a state of oceanic oneness, which is how Freud understood meditative practices. Times began to change, of course, and biological psychiatry and empirically supported psychosocial treatments became all the rage. And then we didn't talk about what we were doing because nobody wanted to be accused of being a religious mystic in the age of science. Then perhaps 20 years ago, there was really a sea change. DBT showed up, right? Dialectical behavior therapy showed up as a treatment for borderline conditions and suicidality and difficulty with emotional regulation. Then a little bit after that, ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy showed up, which was an empirically based treatment that was mindfulness and orientation. It was one of the acceptance-based treatments. So that got mindfulness practices to be legitimized. And in more recent years, things like compassion-focused therapy that comes out of the UK and Paul Gilbert's work that also has a strong empirical data to support it, and self-compassion work, Kristen Neff's work that has a strong empirical base, started showing up on the scene. So that this move from being, you know, quite fringe, quite the, you know, the interest of aging hippies to being fairly mainstream in the mental health field. And what I'll be able to share with you is we're not going to go over a lot of the empirical data on how mindfulness works for this or that. That is readily available to you. But I'm going to try to share with you what the experience is of somebody who has spent a lifetime doing these practices and spent a lifetime doing psychotherapy and seeing we're not going to learn a 12-step program or a protocol. We're going to look at the principles of how mindfulness practices resolve psychological distress and see how those principles might be integrated into psychotherapy more broadly so that we could address a wide range of distress and also so that we could tailor the practices to the needs of individuals, because these are not one size fits all practices. In fact, mindfulness practice or compassion practice is a misnomer. These describe baskets of practices, related activities, all of which have somewhat different neurobiological signatures, all of which have somewhat different psychosocial effects. And some of them are much more appropriate for a given individual in one circumstance than another. You'll hear me talk about my colleague at Brown, Willoughby Britton, who has completed a 10 plus year study on the adverse effects of mindfulness practices. If these things are powerful enough to be useful, they're powerful enough to make trouble. And, you know, think of fire as an example. It's true of, frankly, everything that's useful. And indeed, people have gotten into a lot of difficulties with mindfulness practices, getting stuck in states of dissociation, getting stuck in states of anxiety, getting flooded by sadness. Like any other intervention, mindfulness practices have to be used to help people work in a zone of tolerance, a way so that they can work with what's difficult in their life, but not be overwhelmed by it. So we're going to be exploring that as well. So, you know, on the personal side with mindfulness practices, the, you know, when I first started taking these up, I was super impressed by their power. You know, I started tasting my food. I started actually noticing what was happening somatically in my body. I started experiencing trees. I started having moments where I wasn't involved in obsessional anxiety. My concerns about my adolescent girlfriend got to be, you know, a little bit more in perspective. My worries about academics started mattering not so much. And I thought, you know, this is great stuff. I imagine that by the time I was old, which at that time was, I imagine being old was being in your mid to late 20s, you know, I would be hanging around in states of bliss, enjoying the present moment, and everybody would love me. Well, it hasn't exactly turned out as expected. It turns out that these practices, while very powerful, do not actually insulate you from the ups and downs of life. They give you tools to work with the ups and downs of life. And luckily, I've had exposure to a wide variety of mindfulness and compassion teachers, some Western, some from Asian backgrounds. And, you know, the role, and this may be a little surprising, the role of a mindfulness teacher, and we'll see this because it's quite akin to the role of a psychotherapist, is to help individuals to see the patterns of mind that create suffering, basically seeing how we get in our own way. You know, while my friend Jon Kabat-Zinn, disseminated mindfulness practices by developing mindfulness-based stress reduction, reducing stress is really a side effect of these practices. They were designed in their original wisdom tradition, and we use them in psychotherapy to really see how the mind and heart work together, really see the patterns that create suffering, and through seeing these, see how we might unravel them, see how we might choose different pathways. So of all my different mindfulness teachers, probably the most powerful have been my twin daughters. And they were really, really effective teachers when they were adolescents. I don't know if any of you have had adolescent kids, but you know, adolescents have a way of illuminating how the mind creates suffering in a way that no other person can, you know, can do quite as skillfully. So since some of you are relatively new to the practice, let's start at the beginning with what mindfulness is. You know, mindfulness practices, as we're using them in Western psychotherapy and almost all of the ones that have been studied empirically, have actually derived from Buddhist traditions. Now, that's not because there's anything inherently Buddhist about mindfulness practice. It's these practices have actually been developed to some degree in every culture in the world, because every culture has found itself suffering psychologically or has simply noticed that having greater attention is useful. You know, the paleontologists suspect, it's hard to know for sure, but they suspect that these practices began actually in hunter-gatherer times, where it was quite helpful to be able to sit still and observe carefully. If you could imagine yourself on the African savanna or in a jungle, being able to sit still, observe carefully, regulate your emotional response would actually be optimal for noticing when there's prey around and being able to wait till the prey comes close before going after it. So these things are pretty universal, but of all the cultures of the world, they have been refined in Buddhist traditions to a greater degree than any other. In fact, we have a 2,600 year history now of monks and nuns, each of whom have done tens of thousands of hours of practice, and they wrote about their experience. They wrote about what this practice did to consciousness, what that practice did to consciousness, what doing it in this state or that state did to consciousness. So we have this treasure trove of empirical data in the form of detailed autobiographical reports of how these practices work. And these are what most of us in the West have drawn upon in terms of adapting these practices to use in clinical settings. And the word for mindfulness in Pali, which was the historical, the language in which the teachings of the historical Buddha were written down, is sati. And sati literally means remembering. A little bit more broadly, it connotes awareness, attention, and remembering. And there's a critique of this that's gone around among Buddhist scholars for decades now, which goes like this. It says, if you imagined a scholar, if you imagined a sniper poised on top of a building, getting ready to take out an innocent victim, that sniper would be very aware, very attentive, and every time his mind wandered from the task at hand, he'd be coming right back to it. And what these scholars have pointed out is, certainly in the clinical setting, that kind of consciousness is probably not what we're trying to cultivate either in ourselves as clinicians or in our patients, right? Something's missing. And I like to think of what's missing as a psychotherapist as the Rogers, Carl and Mister. For those of you who aren't familiar with Carl Rogers, you may recall him from Psychology 101, even if you're not in the psychotherapy biz or mental health trained. But he was the psychologist who really put the systematic development of empathy on the map. Rogers described, and he had such an elegant and eloquent description of empathy. He said, empathy is to feel the feelings of another as though they were one's own, but without losing the perspective of as though. In other words, getting it that we're resonating to the feelings of the other. You know, we now suspect that the capacity for empathy comes through mirror neurons, right? This observation that was made long time ago, now, not that long, but some time ago now, you know, among primatologists studying macaque monkeys. And, you know, the macaque monkeys have electrodes measuring neural activity in all different parts of the brain. And during a break, you know, the researcher starts to eat a banana, and suddenly brain regions associated with eating start to fire in the macaque monkey. And they say, wow, what's going on there? And it's simply noticing that when we see another person or even an animal engaged in an activity, we imagine ourselves to be doing it, and we actually feel that subjectively in our own bodies. If you have ever gone to a scary film or an erotic film, you know mirror neurons, right? Because we feel it in our body when we're experiencing it in the other. So Rogers was kind of the master of this kind of empathic resonance. And what he felt was important psychotherapeutically was to have a sense of profound acceptance of whatever arises emotionally, both for the clinician who's having the empathic resonance, as well as teaching the patient, or he would call them clients, how to do this. The other Roger, who may not be familiar to all of you, who did a children's show and who was the master at communicating, you're okay, sweetheart, just the way you are, right? you're okay, sweetheart. And we're going to come back to this very simple idea that you're okay, sweetheart, because it is so the essence of compassion practices and self-compassion practices. And interestingly, the lack of an internalized sense that you're okay, sweetheart, plays an outsized role in a wide range of psychological distress and psychopathology. So adding the Rogers to this, we have a sense of non-judgment, acceptance, kindness, and friendliness. Really, we're adding love to awareness. So it's awareness, attention, remembering with love is the essence of mindfulness practice. So putting this together, we say that therapeutic mindfulness is awareness of present experience with loving acceptance. Excuse me. You know, now that mindfulness practices have been integrated into so many different forms of treatment, and there are so many empirical studies of mindfulness and chronic pain, mindfulness and addictions, mindfulness and leadership, all sorts of things, there have been many attempts to measure mindfulness. And the reason you'd want to measure it is, let's say you come up with an intervention, let's use a psychotherapeutic intervention as an example, and people seem to get better. Well, you want to know, was the mindfulness what got people better, right? And well, one way you could get to this is to simply develop a control group that received some other activity that was, you know, required the same amount of time and effort, but wasn't mindfulness practice, and compared to the people get better who are in the mindfulness group than the control group. But if you really want to drill down to mechanisms of action, what you'd want to do is measure levels of mindfulness before and after the intervention and see whether changes in levels of mindfulness correlate to clinical improvement, right? And here's where things get very interesting, because when you try to measure mindfulness practices in this way, you discover that mindfulness practices are very subject to my favorite principle in social psychology, which is the Dunning-Kruger effect. So here's how the Dunning-Kruger effect works. It's named after two social psychologists at Cornell, Dunning and Kruger. And they discovered that across a remarkably wide range of human endeavors, actual competence is inversely proportional to perceived competence. I'll say that again. Actual competence is inversely proportional to perceived competence. We can think of this as the Homer Simpson effect. Homer is supremely confident sometimes as he goes off on one of his misadventures. It's just us in the audience thinking, doesn't look good, right? And the Dunning-Kruger effect was actually first explored in the range of measuring intelligence and IQ. It turns out that people who on objective measures are below the median in intellectual capacity routinely overrate their intelligence. You can see this in the public sphere in political circles today. People whose abilities are actually below the mean, or actually above the mean, misappraise their skills in the other direction, see themselves as less competent. If you've ever spoken to a newly minted PhD or MD, you know, they, or DDS for that matter, you know, and you say, wow, you must know a lot about, you know, your field, right? People will say, well, you know, I really know about my specialization, or I really know about, you know, what I did my dissertation on, but the field is vast and it's really quite impossible to know it all. So the way the Dunning-Kruger effect shows up in the field of mindfulness is, if you ask somebody who's relatively new to meditative practices and you say, okay, so are you aware of your present experience with loving acceptance? Most people will endorse that. They'll say, yeah, I know what's going on and here now. And yeah, I'm accepting of that. If you ask somebody who's been at it for decades, they'll say, well, there was this moment. I remember, I sat a 3-week silent retreat, and sometime in the middle of the second week, I was sitting on this grassy hill, and I was actually looking at a flower, and for a few seconds, maybe 5, maybe even 10 seconds, I was really present. I was really there without a lot of judgment. I was aware of my present experience with loving acceptance. And then that changed, like all phenomena change. So the problem here in assessing mindfulness is people who have cultivated this deliberately see themselves as terribly unmindful. Because one of the effects of mindfulness practices is to develop what, I once gave a talk at Google, and the engineers at Google are quite interested in mindfulness practice. And there they refer to it as cultivating higher resolution consciousness, more pixels per square centimeter of awareness, if you will. And when we have this higher resolution consciousness, we notice all the ways in which the mind is not present. Now, as it turns out, the people developing scales picked up on this early on and realized that if you're going to measure mindfulness, you do much better to look at everyday mindlessness and ask people about that. There's a greater chance that we'll be able to recognize that. So lucky for you, I am an expert in mindlessness. I have spent decades being mindless, so I can give you some examples of what this looks like. One way it looks is operating on autopilot. A classic example is driving on autopilot. Now, there's a need to be somewhat on autopilot when we drive. Of course, you know, a new driver who's like conscious of where's the signal, what's that other car doing, and is anxiously so, might not be as skilled as somebody who has automated some of these processes, but we automate quite a bit. For example, I was going to give a talk on this topic years ago in the Boston area, and I live west of town, and the way to get into the city is to travel east on our major thoroughfare. Some of you are from this area, the Massachusetts Turnpike. And suddenly, I was distracted. God knows what I was thinking about. Suddenly, I discovered that I was going west rather than east on the Mass Turnpike. And it was one of our country's earlier toll roads, so the exits are spaced quite far apart. And I had plenty of time to contemplate what had happened. So questions arose, like, who is driving the automobile? And we're going to dig into this a little bit later. I had no conscious recollection of any, we'll call it volitional entity that I might call Ron, having had anything to do with the matter, right? The body was there, clearly the car was there, and the body was driving the car, and it went west, but consciousness was lost in the thought stream. It was lost in some reverie about plans, right? About, you know, how I'm going to do this thing, how it's going to go and the like. And even if you haven't done that, there are so many activities that we do on automatic such that they don't even register in consciousness. Like, where did I put my keys, right? The mind was in the thought stream while the body was putting down the keys. There are other examples. How many of you have had the thought since we began today, I wonder if this guy's going to be any good? And you can just do a show of hands about this. Anybody had that thought? I know some of you are from parts of the country that are more polite than New England or from other countries as well, but you know, if you've signed up for a whole week of this, you better hope I'm gonna be good. Otherwise it's gonna be, you know, a real drag, right? So of course we start to think, I wonder if this guy's gonna be any good. And when we go to a restaurant, when the days when we could go to restaurants, you know, it's like, what should I order? You know, will I like this? You know, maybe I should get the poached salmon over wilted spinach, that would be so healthy, but the lasagna looks great, right? We're always in the thought stream, imagining the future in some way and making calculations based on that future. We spend an amazing amount of time lost in the future, or else if we're depressive or ashamed about something, perhaps we're spending more time reviewing the past. We don't spend a lot of time savoring wonderful things that happened in the past. This is because of the negativity bias. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but we either spend time feeling bad about something that happened in the past or engaging in fantasies of the future, sometimes pleasant, sometimes not. We also do let me ask you this. Are any of you let's see, can I see everybody here? I think I can. Anybody here a native New Yorker other than me? I'm a native New Yorker. Anybody else? Oh, several native New Yorkers. Hi. Okay, you guys can't answer this because you'll know the answer from epigenetic transmission or something. So I want non-native New Yorkers, and please don't answer if you've read this somewhere or you know about it from a book. I've written about it elsewhere because I love it as a story. But if you really don't know the answer, I want you to guess. What would you guess would be the leading cause of admissions to emergency units or emergency rooms in Manhattan on Sunday mornings? And feel free to unmute yourself just to lay out a guess. If you had to guess and you really didn't know, don't be shy.
Alcohol.
Excellent guess. Other guesses?
Same thing.
What's that?
I was going to say the same thing.
Same thing. Okay. What other possibilities might there be? Just feel free to unmute yourself and guess. See, this is the kind of going against the training that says, don't speak if you don't know. You don't know.
I heard you say it. I'm disqualified.
You're a New Yorker. You can't say it. Yeah. Marga, were you going to say it?
Suicidal ideation.
Other excellent possibility. Let's have one more guess.
Chest pain.
Absolutely. I had a supervisee once who did an entire doctoral dissertation on non-cardiac chest pain. He's a psychologist, but you know, basically all the different things that can make us come in with chest pain. All excellent examples. It's very interesting. As I've taught in different parts of the country and the world, you get different responses. You know, in Texas, they all say gunshot wounds, right? People, you know, base it on their context. The actual answer is bagel cutting incidents, right? And it turns out that, you know, people are there Sunday morning and, you know, they're cutting bagels. And I was actually talking about this once in Texas, and a guy said, you know, it happened to me. I was in Manhattan with my sister. She lives there. And once again, we got to talking about our mother, right? And it got kind of animated. And sure enough, one hand cut right through the flesh of the other. And I couldn't get the bleeding to stop. I went to the emergency room. And the first thing the triage nurse said to me was, you know, these accidents are the leading cause of admissions here every Sunday morning. So apparently it's true, not just the story that we tell ourselves. And even if you haven't had a bagel cutting incident, I'm sure you have broken or spilled things because of not paying attention, right? And, you know, the majority of traffic accidents happen because of this. I mean, this is why, it's turned out to be more challenging than originally expected, but why autonomous vehicles seem like they would hold such promise, because they won't get distracted. They'll be able to stay attentive because they don't have other things going on in their minds. And then finally, we have the bizarre reality that even though most of the time we're not paying attention, the things that matter to us tend to involve paying attention. So here too, let me just ask you to just unmute yourself and just think of a moment that was deeply meaningful in your life. You know, a moment that you cherish in some way. And just share, let's just share what a few of those moments were.
Childbirth,
certainly.
Family wedding.
Retreat for a big birthday. We won't say which number.
A retreat for a big number birthday, okay.
4-year-old coming to you and hugging you after daycare.
Absolutely. One more.
My daughter's first piano recital.
Your daughter's first piano recital. Thank you so much. Now, in all of those moments, as well as others that came to mind for other folks, were those primarily moments in which you were like making plans, going through your to-do list, trying to figure out what to do next and, you know, in the future? Or were those moments of pretty full presence where, you know, the body was there, your attention was there, your feelings were open, and you were really present for the situation? The correct answer is those were moments of presence, right? The moments of our life that matter to us are all moments of relatively wholehearted presence. And yet, we spend so much time not being wholeheartedly present. In fact, we spend a remarkable amount of time rushing through activities, trying to get to the good stuff, right? This is, let me finish my paperwork so I can go home. Let me get past this traffic so I can be, you know, see my friends or get to the party or whatever it is. One of the things we're gonna notice throughout this course is just how often our minds are imagining the next Shangri-La experience, right? That, well, this is okay, or this is a little unpleasant, but this next moment's gonna be great. And the problem with this is, as Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a wonderfully, I mean, he's had a bad stroke now and isn't very functional, but who is a wonderfully skilled Vietnamese Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh used to say all the time, if you don't enjoy doing the dishes, you're unlikely to enjoy the cup of tea. Because it is a propensity of mind, a state of mind of toppling forward, going to the next, going to the next, going to the next, imagining that this next thing is going to be so great. But that state of mind, unfortunately, we bring it into the next thing. So that even when we're in the nice situation, we're still buzzing, we're still imagining the next, and we're unable to really savor it and really be present. I'm sorry to say it gets worse. It turns out that life is actually difficult for everybody. And there are many reasons for this, but I'd like to just highlight a few that are particularly relevant to mindfulness practice. And particularly relevant to times of instability also. So the first is that everything changes. There's a psychoanalytic writer named Judith Viorst who in the 1980s wrote a book that was on the bookshelf of many a psychotherapist in North America. It was called Necessary Losses. And her premise was that you could understand an awful lot of human psychological suffering as our difficulty dealing with loss. And this starts very early on. I don't want to give up my diapers and start using the potty. The current arrangement has suited me just fine. School with all those weird other kids and that teacher person? Forget about it. I'd much rather stay home with mommy or daddy or whoever my caretaker is. And this persists throughout the lifetime, the life cycle. You know, when I gave my, here's my twin daughters as teachers again, you know, so there I was in my, mid-30s or so, and terrified of having twins. And it also became clear quite early on that our old Toyota Corolla, which was a smaller vehicle in those days, was just not gonna cut it with this amount of baby paraphernalia. So we bought a minivan, and you know, I didn't feel like cool driving around in a minivan. And then, you know, 17, 18 years later, they're ready to go off to the university. And I wasn't so sanguine about that, right? You know, here I was having spent all of these years not only avoiding being reported to protective services, but actually developing, you know, something of a loving, connected relationship with them. And now they were going to abandon me the same way I remember other girls abandoning me when they were 18 and I was 18. Now, who wrote this script? You know, luckily, my wife has a little bit more wisdom than I do about these matters. And she was able to point out that had they been impaired in a way where they couldn't go to college, I'd probably be more upset. But I was still pretty upset. And where I stand now at this developmental stage, and I look forward to the future, I think, oh, there are marvelous changes ahead. There's the potential for assisted living, skilled nursing, intensive care. I mean, you know, this is the built-in existential changes, the fact that everything changes and, you know, let me ask you, how many of you are going to die? You know, ultimately, change is going to be very challenging for all of us. And going through difficult times, like coronavirus times, for example, so many things that people thought, oh, well, this is how the world works. This is how my life is. This is what I do. Oh, yeah? Nope. All up for grabs. And, you know, we look throughout human history and people were much more aware that things were grossly unstable, everything was impermanent, and you can't hold on to anything. Because it used to be that death was, you saw it everywhere. And, you know, think before antibiotics in the 1940s, if you got a cut, it was like, you know, not that hard to die from it, right? I mean, you know, everybody in the Civil War, they, you know, they weren't dying so much from the injuries per se. They died from disease and infection that we didn't have any way to treat. So, life is difficult because everything changes and we can't control it. It's also difficult because we are inordinately preoccupied with ourselves. And we're going to dig into this in some detail because this is one of the key insights that comes from mindfulness practice. We start to notice that we spend all day, every day, talking to ourselves about ourselves. And a lot of this talk is self-evaluative. How am I doing, right? Am I doing a good job now? Am I not doing a good job now? This has come up at least 100 times already just in beginning to teach this seminar, right? But it happens all the time. You get up, how do I look, right? Oh, you step on the scale. How am I doing? How do I weigh? You know, has my weight gone up? Has it gone down? How's my diet? You have breakfast. Oh, oatmeal and fruit. That was healthy. I'm on track. You know, boy, I really should not have the pizza for lunch though. Endless talking to ourselves about ourselves. And we also make a lot of comparisons with others. We'll dig into this a little bit later, because what I'm going to propose is that this preoccupation with ourselves and how we're doing and how we compare with others, which causes inordinate suffering. Those of you who work with people in psychological distress, you know, what percentage of your clients or patients feel not good enough in some way, feel in some way inadequate, feel in some way that they're failing, right? This is like ubiquitous, right? This is such a big part of our psychological struggles. And what I'm going to propose to you, and we'll dig into this more in a bit, is that this is actually the human equivalent of pecking orders, that virtually all organisms organize themselves into dominance hierarchies. And in these dominance hierarchies, those who are doing better have access to more resources, do a better job propagating their DNA, and are gonna come out better in the long run, and will survive better. So that this has been selected for through natural selection. And the way it shows up in us psychologically is with a great deal of self-preoccupation. And one of the things mindfulness practices are designed to do is to get us less self-preoccupied. And we're gonna dig into that in some depth. Okay. So let's put this together. How might mindfulness practices help us with all this? Okay, well, they can help us to see and accept things as they are, rather than to simply be spending each day fighting reality and trying to have things differently, be different. As one of my patients put it, you know, when you fight reality, reality usually wins, but only 100% of the time. And many of the ways in which we fight reality is by constructing defenses, imagining that which is impermanent can be permanent, imagining we can control that which we can't control, imagining that we're not going to age and die, imagining all sorts of things, imagining that pain can be eliminated or controlled, all sorts of ways in which we fight reality that actually, where the fight itself makes us miserable. We're going to use these practices to loosen our preoccupation with self, because as I mentioned, our narratives about ourselves get us into terrible trouble. They make it so that all sorts of thoughts and feelings are prohibited, because I'm not a person who would feel that. They make it so that we get caught up in all sorts of competitive concerns, and they make it so that we so easily feel we're not good enough, or feel shame, or feel like we're not part of the human family. And all of this comes from being preoccupied with ourselves. To actually experience the richness of the moment, because as we, you know, look at this with clear eyes, we realize that life is just a series of moments. So if I could actually live them more fully, I could have more meaningful moments in my life. And out of all of this, we learned how to act skillfully in the world. And we learned how to make decisions that aren't so much going for immediate short-term gain, pleasure in the moment, but make decisions that are going to reduce suffering both for ourselves and others more consistently and more reliably in the long run. Okay, sound good? So what's entailed in developing this mindfulness stuff? Well, to develop mindfulness, we do mindfulness practices. And this is the relationship between mindfulness and mindfulness practice is akin to what we see vis-a-vis physical fitness, right? Physical fitness is strength, endurance, and flexibility, while mindfulness is awareness of present experience with loving acceptance. To develop physical fitness, we do a gym workout or go jogging or go bike riding, something like that. To develop mindfulness, we're going to do mindfulness practices. And because, as I mentioned, many of these practices are coming from Buddhist traditions, it's easy for those of us in the West, if we're not steeped in these, to have misconceptions about them. And I want to clarify some of these disabuse us of some of these misconceptions, both for our own practice, but also these are the misconceptions that our clients or patients are going to have if we're going to teach mindfulness practices to them. And so they're very useful to identify and inoculate, if you will, people against them before starting the practice. So the first misconception is that the goal of these practices is to have a blank mind. There's a story I once heard Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's done a lot to bring mindfulness practices into Western medicine, that he tells about leading a retreat, and a guy brings a Bazooka Joe comic. And in this comic, there was a Joe, who's the protagonist, is sitting in full lotus meditation posture, accompanied by his sidekick, Mort. And Joe is saying, "Since I've discovered meditation, my mind is a complete blank." And Mort is looking at him saying, "Gee, Joe, I thought you were born that way." The idea of these practices is not to lose our capacity for higher cortical processes. It's not about not thinking. In fact, if we try not to think, it becomes like try not to think of a flying elephant. The mind is possessed with winged pachyderms if we do that, right? The very resistance to thought creates more thought. Rather, what these practices do is they develop what in cognitive behavior therapy is called metacognitive awareness, the ability to see a thought as a thought and not believe in it nor identify with it. But as you'll see, we're going to allow thoughts to come and go and come and go, but try to create this perspective, the sense of being able to note and identify thoughts rather than believing in them. Second misconception is that this is going to get rid of difficult emotions. After all, people don't take up mindfulness practices when they've just won the lottery, gotten a promotion, and fallen in love, right? They don't start going to church. They don't start psychotherapy. They don't take up yoga class usually in these moments, unless their beloved is a yoga person. But we take up these because we're having some difficult feeling. We're struggling with sadness, with anxiety, with anger, with something like that, with shame, and we want it to go away. Well, this is a big disappointment. Mindfulness practices do not help emotions to go away. Rather, what they do is they increase our sensitivity to emotions so that we feel them more vividly. This is the higher resolution consciousness. However, there's a paradox here, that as we open to the emotions, they become more fluid. They get less stuck. So they have a shorter tail to them, if you will. And as their tail diminishes, as emotions come and go more fluidly and we feel them more vividly, suffering is diminished because, as we'll see, most psychological distress involves resisting some emotional experience. And it's the resistance of the emotional experience that gets us caught in it. These practices are not about withdrawing from life, even though, as you'll see when we do the practice, we're going to turn inward. We're going to pay attention to what's happening in the body and the mind here and now, but not for the purpose of becoming a hermit. They're for the purpose of having this kind of higher resolution consciousness and this fluidity and openness to emotion and this capacity for empathic resonance, so that we can engage more fully in the interpersonal world and connect more deeply with other people. And even though pleasant states will sometimes arise, they're not about seeking bliss. If we get attached to the pleasant state, we're just gonna get stuck. It's not gonna, we'll have fewer pleasant states the more attached to bliss we are. And they're not about escaping pain, even physical pain. As we'll see, these practices are about changing our relationship to pain rather than escaping it in any way. Now, so let me ask you a question here. And again, you can just unmute yourself to respond. How are the following three things alike? Okay, this is a little bit of a puzzler. The three things are swimming, making love, and eating a gourmet meal. What might they have in common? And just feel free to unmute yourself and play with this a little bit.
Sensory elements.
They definitely have sensory elements. That's true. What else do they have in common?
Joy.
Joy. And that probably depends on with whom you're making love and how you are as a swimmer. But yes, they have the potential for joy.
Yes, pleasure.
Pleasure. They have the potential for pleasure.
Joy and pleasure, yeah.
Again, depends on with whom you're making love, but yes. What else? Well, those are all excellent answers. I was actually thinking of something a little different. I was thinking that swimming, making love, and eating a gourmet meal, talking about them is very different from doing them. And the same is actually quite true of mindfulness practices. So I'm going to invite you now to do some practice. And we're going to do a simple, largely breath-focused practice.